At the United Nations Security Council, the Secretary General urged members to pass a ceasefire resolution.
Intense bombardment and hostilities, Israeli restrictions on movement, fuel shortages, and interrupted communications make it impossible for UN agencies and their partners to reach most of the people in need.
Plus, as the fighting continues, some 200,000 Israelis have been evacuated from areas near the conflict.
In the meantime, all of the evacuees have been living in limbo in hotels and guest houses all over Israel, including the Ya'arim Hotel at Ma'aleh HaChamisha outside of Jerusalem.
And later, Russian President Vladimir Putin announces his bid for another term in office. Today is Friday, December 8th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll go to the Gaza and Israel conflict in a moment, but we begin today's program with what could be a huge global crisis in the making in the Taiwan Strait. That's where Taiwan's defense ministry says it spotted a Chinese surveillance balloon along with large-scale movements of military aircraft and ships. The AP's Charles de Ledesma has the story.
Taiwan says the balloon passed over the northern port city of Keelung on Thursday night, then continued east before disappearing. Taiwan has threatened to shoot down such balloons, but the ministry did not say what, if any, action was taken. In response to a media query, China spokesman Wang Wenbin says, "First of all, I want to remind you that Taiwan is part of China, and there's no such thing as a foreign ministry or defense ministry in Taiwan." Wenbin then said, "I'm not aware of the balloon situation, and it is not a diplomatic question." Taiwan adds, as of Friday morning, 26 Chinese military aircraft and 10 Navy ships had been detected. It said 15 of the aircraft crossed the median line that's an unofficial divider between the sides. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
And now to the crisis in Israel and Gaza. Ahead of a UN Security Council vote on Friday for a resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres told members that while the UN is committed to stay and deliver aid to those in need, the situation is becoming untenable.
The conditions for the effective delivery of humanitarian aid no longer exist. The crossing point at Rafah was not designed for hundreds of trucks and is a major bottleneck. But even if sufficient supplies were permitted into Gaza, intense bombardment and hostilities, Israeli restrictions on movement, fuel shortages, and interrupted communications make it impossible for UN agencies and their partners to reach most of the people in need.
Citing the World Food Programme, he said there is a serious risk of starvation and famine.
In northern Gaza, 97% of households are not eating enough. In the south, the figure among displaced people is 83%. Half the people of the north and more than one-third of displaced people in the south are simply starving. WFP's own food stocks are running out. In the north, 9 out of 10 people have spent at least one full day and night without food. The last functioning flour mill in Gaza was destroyed on 15 November. WFP has provided food and cash assistance to hundreds of thousands of people across Gaza since the crisis began and is ready to scale up its operation. However, that would require effective access to all people in need and at least 40 trucks of food supplies every day, many times the current level.
Guterres also painted a dire picture of Gaza's hospital system, saying it is collapsing while needs are escalating.
At least 286 health workers have been killed. Hospitals have suffered heavy bombardments. Just 14 out of 36 are still functioning. Of these, 3 are providing basic first aid, while the others are delivering partial services. The European Gaza Hospital, one of the two main hospitals in southern Gaza, has 370 beds. It is currently housing 1,000 patients and an estimated 70,000 people seeking shelter. There are critical shortages of drugs, blood products, and medical supplies. Fuel to run the hospitals is severely rationed. many patients are being treated on the floor and without anesthetics. As patients with life-threatening injuries continue to arrive, wards are overflowing and staff are overwhelmed. At the same time, the unsanitary conditions in shelters and severe shortages of food and water are leading to increases in respiratory infections, scabies, jaundice, and diarrhea.
The Secretary General condemned the brutal October 7th terror attacks on Israel and is appalled by the reports of sexual violence. Guterres called for the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages.
At the same time, the brutality perpetrated by Hamas can never justify the collective punishment of the Palestinian people. And while indiscriminate rocket fire by Hamas into Israel and the use of civilians as human shields are in contravention with the laws of war, such conduct does not absolve Israel on its own violations. International humanitarian law includes the duty to protect civilians and to comply with the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution. The laws of war also demand that civilians' essential needs must be met, including by facilitating the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian relief. International humanitarian law cannot be applied selectively. It is binding on all parties equally at all times, and the obligation to observe it does not depend on reciprocity.
He told the Council that the international community must do everything in its power to enact a ceasefire and to facilitate the delivery of aid, and he suggested the only possibility of a long-lasting peace was the two-state solution, where Israelis and Palestinians could live side by side in peace and security.
The eyes of the world and the eyes of history are watching. It's time to act.
On Thursday, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in his strongest public criticism of Israel's conduct of the war yet, said there was a gap between the government's declared intentions to protect civilians and the casualties. Reuters' Diane Toe has that story.
It remains imperative that Israel put a premium on civilian protection. And there does remain a gap between exactly what I said when I was there, the intent to protect civilians, and the actual results that we're seeing on the ground.
Blinken was speaking at a news conference following a meeting with Britain's foreign secretary in Washington. It comes as Israeli forces continue their bombardment of the Palestinian enclave, battling Hamas militants in Gaza's biggest cities. Israel has said it is doing everything possible to get civilians out of harm's way, including warnings about military operations. Blinken is due to meet top diplomats from Arab states, including Egypt, in Washington on Friday. The United Arab Emirates has asked for the UN Security Council to vote Friday morning on a draft resolution for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza. But the United States, which has veto power in the Council, opposes a ceasefire because it believes that would only benefit Hamas. According to the White House, U.S. President Joe Biden spoke separately by phone with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Jordan's King Abdullah, stressing the critical need to protect civilians. And in a further development on humanitarian assistance, Israel has agreed to a U.S. request to open the Kerem Shalom border crossing at the junction of Gaza, Egypt, and Israel to screen aid trucks headed for Gaza. That's according to a senior U.S. official who said it would help speed up the inspection process for desperately needed aid to be sent to Gaza through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. On the time frame of the border opening, an Israeli official told reporters on Thursday, quote, "It will happen in the next few days."
That's Diane Toe of Reuters. We'll have updates on the Council's scheduled vote on our website, voanews.com. Death is, sadly, a fact of war, a point that was poignantly brought home in Jerusalem, where the son of a former Israeli military chief and a current member of Israel's war cabinet was laid to rest. He had been killed while fighting in Gaza. Gadi Eisenkot is a member of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's war cabinet and the former chief of staff of Israel's army. He is addressing his son's coffin.
I promise to you that we will do everything to be worthy in making the right decisions for those who have sacrificed, for your brothers in arms, and for the Israeli people who are hugging us in this difficult time.
Benny Gantz is a centrist in the Israeli Knesset, but also a former army general and defense minister. He addressed his friend Gadi at his son's funeral.
Gadi.
Gadi, when we approved plans, we understood their meaning. We knew that the arrows marked on the map can become arrows in the hearts of many fine and beloved families. And you, my brother and friend in arm, my partner, you and your family are the embodiment of giving a personal example of holding the national interest above any personal interest. You've understood well the meaning of it.
The Israeli military said Thursday that Master Sergeant Gal Meir Eisenkot was 25 years old. He died in battle in northern Gaza. Meanwhile, Palestinians searched through the rubble of damaged and destroyed houses at the site of an Israeli strike in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, more than 17,000 Palestinians have been killed and 46,000 wounded since Israel responded to the Hamas terror attack on October 7th. And over in the West Bank, the Palestinian Health Ministry says Israeli forces killed 5 Palestinians during a raid near Tubas. VOA has not been able to independently verify the claims by either organization. You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. About 200,000 Israelis have been evacuated from their homes in communities near the border with Gaza in the south or Lebanon in the north. They've been living in hotels and guest houses for 2 months now, and they have no idea when they'll be able to go home. Lindsay Gradstein reports.
Some of the about 200,000 Israelis evacuated from communities near the borders with Gaza and Lebanon have nowhere to return to after their homes were bombed or burned by Hamas militants on October 7th. In the meantime, all of the evacuees have been living in limbo in hotels and guest houses all over Israel, including the Ya'arim Hotel at Ma'ale HaChamisha outside of Jerusalem. They say they don't know when or if they will feel safe enough to return. Or Amar Ashush is from a community very close to the Gaza border. She says nobody can promise them that another Hamas assault won't happen. Many fled their homes immediately after the Hamas attack with nothing but the clothes on their backs. Volunteers mobilized to collect and distribute thousands of cartons of clothing, toys, and household items for the evacuee centers. This hotel provides room and 3 meals a day, as well as health services and recreational activities. Children have been integrated into local schools, and a nursery school has been opened inside the hotel. Ada Brodsky is a nursery school teacher at the hotel.
In the beginning, they were very frightened. Any loud noise would scare them. There's a house here that was built by a volunteer that came, and many of the kids would crawl into it and find a safe haven for themselves. And they would close the windows and the doors. They would put blankets over the windows so that the baddies wouldn't be able to come in and find them.
About 400 of the original 550 evacuees from 2 Gaza border communities remain at the Ma'ale HaChamisha Hotel. Some have found alternative housing, either renting apartments or moving in with relatives. They say that families living long-term in small hotel rooms is challenging, especially for those already coping with trauma and stress. Shiran Asaraf Michaeli is the evacuee coordinator at the hotel. She says many of them are still traumatized from the events of October 7th. More than 1 million Palestinians in Gaza have also been displaced by the fighting, which has destroyed their homes. More than 80% of Gaza's population of 2.3 million is now crowded into the southern Gaza Strip, where they are living in United Nations schools and facilities. The Israeli evacuees say they are anxious to move back home, even though they recognize that it may take a long time, if ever, to feel safe in their homes again. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Ma'alea Chamisha, Israel.
In Washington, the Biden administration is running out of time to secure a deal of tens of billions of dollars in wartime aid for Ukraine and Israel that Senate Republicans blocked on Wednesday. President Joe Biden has signaled that he's willing to compromise on Republicans' demands on border security to get the package through, but his aides accuse Republicans of ignoring Biden's proposal. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has this report.
Images released by the Ukrainian army shows the damage in the aftermath of a Russian attack in the southern city of Kherson this week, as U.S. funding for Kyiv's defense against Moscow's invasion is blocked by Senate Republicans, who are demanding tougher measures to secure the U.S. border with Mexico. Republican Senator Jim Risch speaking to VOA.
We Republicans are very serious about closing our southern border. We have about over 10,000 people a day, illegals crossing into the United States. We need to defend our border first and foremost.
The White House says Republicans have ignored its border and immigration reform proposal. President Joe Biden warned on Wednesday that if Kyiv loses its war, Russian President Vladimir Putin will move beyond Ukraine to attack a NATO member, and the U.S. will be obligated to defend it.
Then we'll have something that we don't seek and that we don't have today. American troops fighting Russian troops. American troops fighting Russian troops if he moves into other parts of NATO.
Biden has signaled he is willing to compromise, but he says time is running out. There is $4.8 billion remaining in aid for Ukraine, but only $1.1 billion left to replenish U.S. weapons and equipment stockpiles to supply Kyiv what it needs. Emma Ashford, senior fellow with the Reimagining U.S. Grand Strategy Program at the Stimson Center, via Skype.
If U.S. aid doesn't come through, Europeans are likely to step into the breach to some extent. But at a minimum, the Ukrainians are going to have to turn to a more defensive war and potentially start to look for ways to actually end the conflict.
VOA asked National Security Council's John Kirby whether the administration would support ceasefire negotiations.
President Zelensky gets to determine how and when this war ends and under what conditions he's willing to negotiate with Mr. Putin.
To pass $60 billion in aid for Ukraine and $10 billion for Israel, Congress has limited time before the end-of-year break. European partners are nervous. Britain will continue supporting Kyiv, Foreign Secretary David Cameron told VOA on Thursday.
But clearly, America is an essential partner in this. They are the world's biggest economy, the biggest defense player, absolutely vital.
Complicating matters, January 19th is also the first deadline to fund part of the government to prevent a shutdown. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News.
On now to Russia, where Vladimir Putin has declared his candidacy in the presidential election next March. It's an election he is all but certain to win and one that would see him in office for another 6 years. Putin still commands wide support after nearly a quarter century in power, despite having started an immensely costly war in Ukraine that has taken thousands of his countrymen's lives. He's provoked repeated attacks inside Russia, including one on the Kremlin itself, and corroded its aura of invincibility. Anna Chernikova has more on Putin's decision and the war in Ukraine. She joins us from Kyiv.
On Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin officially announced that he will run for president of Russia in the next elections, which are expected in March 2024. While there is no official reaction on this news from Kyiv, Ukrainian society reacted with many jokes on social media. Many sarcastically calling it breaking news and saying it is not a big surprise considering the Russian constitution was amended to allow Putin to become president again and again. Others say Putin is to run for the dictator of Russia, a nickname widely used in Ukraine when talking about the president of Russia. Meanwhile, Russian forces launched a massive missile attack on Ukraine in the early morning of December 8th. There were no casualties and no destruction was reported in the city of Kyiv. However, private houses, vehicles, utility buildings and gas pipelines were damaged in the Kyiv region from falling debris. In the Dnipropetrovsk region, one person was killed and four were injured in Russian attacks. An industrial site, 21 private buildings, and a church were damaged there. Six missiles targeted the city of Kharkiv and Kharkiv region. Two civilians were reported wounded. A children's playground and other civilian objects such as residential buildings, a school, and about 20 vehicles were also damaged. Such attacks are happening in Ukraine every day.
This creates even more concern within Ukrainian society due to the decrease in international aid, and particularly around the uncertainty of future U.S. aid. While the future of U.S. aid remains in doubt, Ukrainians believe U.S. support is crucial for Ukraine's ability to defend itself. Andriy Yermak, the head of the Office of the President of Ukraine, said during his speech at the U.S. Institute of Peace, "If the aid that is currently being discussed in Congress is delayed, it will create a great risk that we will be in the same position as we are now. And of course, this will most likely make it impossible to continue the liberation of the territories and create a great risk of losing the war." The debate in Washington over aid for Ukraine is happening just as winter is beginning, leaving many Ukrainians feeling left out in the cold. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
The governor of Nigeria's Kaduna State on Friday criticized Nigerian defense officials after they said that terrorists had embedded themselves in a village that was hit by an airstrike on Sunday. 87 people were killed. Governor Uba Sani said the statement was careless and lacked empathy. Meanwhile, rights group Amnesty International says the military is trying to cover up atrocities. VOA's Steve Miller has the details.
Residents of Tudunbiri had gathered to mark the birthday of the Muslim prophet Muhammad on Sunday night when the airstrike occurred. The Nigerian army said it was an accident. This week, Nigerian President Bola Tinubu called for a thorough investigation and to hold officials accountable. But Amnesty International says authorities frequently make such promises without taking action and accuse authorities of trying to cover up human rights atrocities by putting out contradictory explanations. Issa Sanusi, Amnesty's Nigeria country director, tells VOA the number of explanations is unnecessary and the focus should be on the investigation. Last December, an airstrike by the Nigerian Air Force killed 64 people in northwest Zamfara State, and 1 month later, a military airstrike killed nearly 40 herders in Nasarawa State, near the capital. Critics say authorities have yet to hold anyone responsible for those killings. Steve Miller, VOA News.
And finally today, elsewhere in Africa, an update on the humanitarian crisis in Sudan. Lisa Schlein reports.
Since rival military leaders plunged Sudan into conflict in mid-April, the country's Ministry of Health reports more than 12,000 people have been killed and over 33,000 injured. Additionally, the World Health Organization says Sudan is facing the world's largest displacement crisis. It reports nearly 6.8 million people have fled their homes, seeking safety in Sudan or in neighboring countries. The WHO representative in Sudan, Mohamed Taufik Mashal, says this mass population movement increases people's vulnerability to diseases, malnutrition, gender-based violence, and acute mental health distress. WHO reports aid delivery to some parts of Sudan, especially in the capital Khartoum and in Darfur, is very difficult because of the violence as Sudan's army and the rival Rapid Support Forces militia battle for control of the country. Mashal says the situation in Darfur is of particular concern. He notes many hospitals are inaccessible and insecurity prevents humanitarian aid from being safely delivered. He says 43% of Sudan's population is at risk of food insecurity. Also, 3.2 million children under 5 reportedly are acutely malnourished, including 700,000 who are severely acutely malnourished, a condition that can lead to death if not treated. Mashal says lack of international support is making it increasingly more difficult for WHO to provide essential health care to the millions in need. He says only $9 million of WHO's $98 million health emergency response plan has been received. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to wrap it up for today. There is more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
Stay up to date with VOA Podcasts. Each weekday, International Edition covers the world's biggest stories while Flashpoint Iran and Flashpoint Ukraine examine their respective regions in depth every week.